So I cried in public, and it's not it's not that great of a story, but like double ear infection, you know that I have one recovering from that. Cool, whatever. But on Thursday, I just rolled out of bed like 15 minutes before I was supposed to be at work. This is before I knew what was wrong with me. So I'm just in this like haze of pain, like pure pain. Head pounding, ears pounding, sick to my stomach, dizzy as fuck, but all my little simple wrapped in cotton brain knows is I'm supposed to be at work right now. So I go to work. I don't remember driving there. This was not safe. I shouldn't have done it. I appear at work, like I've teleported. I forgot all of my stuff in the car, except for my car keys. This is what I have with them. I report for work and everyone is just kind of like looking at me like, are you okay? And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm present. I'm here. I'm ready to work. And they're like, we think you need to go back home.
Oh my God.
And the more they're telling me that I need to go home and go to the doctor, the more upset I'm getting because I already don't feel good. And now everybody's telling me that I look like shit. So I'm starting to tear up, losing it a little bit. And they're like, go, go, go home, go home. And so finally, I'm like, all right, whatever, whatever. I'm getting upset. I'm just going to go home. I find my boss. I'm like, hey, I know I've been here for like 25 minutes, but I'm going to go to the doctor.
Hi.
Go
Yeah.
home. Boss says it's fine. As I'm heading out the door, one of like the boss's boss's bosses stops me. It's like, hey, where are you going? Because they just seen me walk in. I'm like, I'm going to the doctor and I'm going home. And they're like, did you let somebody know? Did you let your boss know? Are you just leaving or have you actually reported to somebody? I straight up, in front of everybody, in front of this manager, lost my shit. Started and she hardcore. She's like, oh my gosh, sweetie, what's wrong? It's okay. Just like, it's okay. It's like, you caused this. I'm bawling in public in front of all of my coworkers and God. I just want to go home.
But that is the power of crying in public.
She let me go so fast.
Yep.
She was like, you're good. You're fine. Go to the doctor. It's okay. It's like, okay, bye.
I love a good public cry. There's nothing like it. It's like the day can
Embarrassing,
only get
but
better.
it's manipulative.
100%. And that's why I do it. And I will not apologize.
What do you cry over in public?
Literally, whatever.
Anything you
Like,
want.
honestly, my car is probably where I cry the most. Like, period. Like, not even like my own house, probably the car. And I don't know why. It's definitely unsafe, but I mean, that's not super public unless someone's like looking at you, which sometimes I'll
Then
be parked in a parking lot. That's pretty public. The Piggly Wiggly, I've cried there in the meat section. I used to cry in church a lot. That was a lot of shame and guilt happening. That was pure trauma. Where else have I cried? I've cried in a library. I've cried at a baseball game. I've cried at a hockey game. Those were more like overstimulation, the sporting events. That'll get me every time, let me tell you. Overstimulated, hot, and like, oof,
Loud.
that'll do it. Yeah, not really recently though. I've been doing my crying inside recently, indoors.
You need to move it outdoors before it gets too cold and you can't.
That's true. Maybe I'll just sit on the patio later and have a good old
Have a
fashioned cry.
Think about something real sad.
No problem. I've got tons of stuff stored away. I can do it at the drop of a hat. Not right now, though. I won't right now. Don't worry.
Okay, thank you.
I am stewing in anxiety. And so I have a lot of energy, nervous energy. I woke up at 3 o'clock because my cat was licking his food bowl repeatedly. And it's just the most disgusting infuriating sound in the whole world. And then I remembered that I am flying to Texas on Friday, and then the anxiety just like washed over me and kept me awake. So I've had a lot of caffeine.
And sugar.
I ate 3 Reese's cups in 1 minute, which is probably a record. It's pretty good. And I'm going to crash on the couch at like 5 p.m.
I'm happy for you.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
I will also crash at 5. I haven't done nothing today.
Nice. Perfect.
It's going to be dark outside. My brain says bedtime.
Well, that's what the cats say. The cats say dinner time at like 4 o'clock now. I'm like, excuse?
Hannibal's still figuring it out too.
Mm-hmm. He's like, God bless him.
Where have you been? Why have you been at work all this time? It's pitch black outside. It's like, I don't know, buddy. I'm sorry. Didn't you?
Capitalism.
Anyway, we should introduce ourselves.
Yeah, probably. Hello. I'm Sarah. I'm a heretic.
Hello, I am Liz. I am tired.
And this is Saints and Witches, the podcast where we tell each other stories about saints and, you guessed it, witches. My story today is one that I've known about forever and just never decided to focus on because the story of the saint itself is pretty short, and we only have hagiographical evidence that he even existed. So it's kind of like the story is a little bit flimsy, but I do like the details in it and like the general vibe of it and the time and place. So I always wanted to tell it. So I decided to just go ahead and do it and take little detours along the way to fill in the gaps, basically. So this is the story of Saint Hubert, or Hubertus, of Liège. He is the patron saint of hunters, or at least one of them. I'm sure there are many patron saints of hunters. And he lived in the 7th and 8th centuries in the kingdom of the Franks. So we are back in Merovingian times, which, as everyone knows, is one of my favorite times in history. It's batshit crazy. If you want more Merovingians, check out episode 21, XOXO Caesar, and episode 61, Catfight City. So we're coming in this time at the tail end of the Merovingian dynasty. Episode 21 was the very beginning, 61 was somewhere in the middle, and this is when the dynasty is coming to an end and its transition into what will be the Carolingian dynasty, which is where we meet Charlemagne. So it's kind of like an awkward time. In episode 61, you talked about Chilperic I and his wife Fredegund, or Fredegunda, who had that like insane beef with Brunhilde, which is where the title Catfight City came from. So Chilperic and Fredegund's son, Clotar II, reunited all of the Frankish kingdoms and became king of all Franks in the year 613. His son, Dagobert I, is widely considered the last Frankish king with any like real power. Kings after this are generally called, ooh, here's some French that I didn't look up. maybe I just won't say it then. Well, I know that it's like raw. I immediately backpedaled. It means do nothing kings. So it's like R-O-I-S. And then Fénon, I think, is how you would say it. I can't do the French R, though. It's not within my power.
You just say it really far in the back of your throat.
Law?
Yeah, like that.
I'm so good at it. Never mind. I can do anything. So the kings are called, like, do nothing kings. At this point, basically, like they're puppets. We also don't have much source material during this time, but shortly after the death of Dagobert is when Hubert, our saint, comes into the picture. Hubert was born around 656 in the region of Aquitaine, which contained the cities of Poitiers, Bordeaux, and Toulouse. Some sources say he was born in Toulouse, some just say Aquitaine. A hagiography says that he was the eldest son of a Frankish duke. Unfortunately, this duke was unnamed, or at least I couldn't find a name. But we do know that Hubert spent his youth in the Neustrian court of Theuderic or Theodoric III in Paris. And Theuderic was the grandson of Dagobert, so the great-grandson of Chilperic, the husband of Fredegund. So, Theuderic, and by the way, I know that I'm pronouncing all these names wrong. Guess what? So would you, listener. You think you're better than me? You're not. Maybe have a little compassion for what I've been going through. What'd you say? What?
I said, go cry in public.
Yeah. Or I'll cry in public. I'll cry publicly on the podcast. Wouldn't be the first time. No shame. I'm never ashamed. So Theuderic was the king of Neustria at the time that Hubert was at his court. He would later become also the king of Austrasia and the king of all Franks, but he is generally seen as a do-nothing king, like a puppet ruler. The story goes that Hubert's charm and agreeable nature led to him being given the office of Count of the Palace, or Count Palatine, which was a big deal, especially in these years of the Merovingian king's decline. Counts of the palace and mayors of the palace were created, the position was created to assist the king, but as the king's fell into decline, the counts and mayors of the palace assumed more and more influence, and in some cases eventually became the actual power behind the throne. It's very much Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, the Steward of Gondor becoming like the ruler. Nerd alert. So we don't know for sure how much influence Hubert had over Theuderic, but it was a very high-ranking office. In the year 682, Hubert married Floriban, the daughter of Dagobert, the Count of Leuven, and the happy couple moved to the Austrasian court of Pepin of Herstal. Basically, why they did this, what happened there, was that Theuderic attacked Austrasia and lost. and Pepin essentially forced a peace treaty on Theuderic and made himself the mayor of all three Frankish kingdoms, which is so funny. We always say mayor as like, I don't remember what his title was, probably the mayor. But in this case, it's like actually true. So the three Frankish kingdoms were Austrasia, Neustria, and Burgundy. He also started calling himself Duke and Prince of the Franks. He was the great-grandfather of Charlemagne. So Pepin was a big deal, and Hubert joined his court and was made Grand Master of Pepin's household. So he's Grand Master of the mayor's household, basically. Everything was going great for Hubert. He was living his best life. His wife was pregnant with their first child. One hagiography I read said that Hubert was, quote-unquote, passionately addicted to the diversion of hunting. So he's got his hobbies, too. He loved the sport, as did most other young men at the time. What else was there to do? You drank and you killed things, basically.
I am fully him as someone from my hometown and like full camo, overall, Budweiser, wife at home.
Bush Light. I think it's Bush Light, actually. But yes, and he's got like one can that he's drinking out of and one can that he's spitting tobacco into, and sometimes he gets them mixed up. But of course, the Wheel of Fortune turns and Hubert's luck eventually ran out. His wife died giving birth to their son, Floribert, which is going on my top 10 list of names. And Hubert, overcome with grief, no longer found any joy in court life. I imagine feasting and drinking in his illustrious position felt sort of empty after his wife's death. The hagiography says that he gave himself up entirely to hunting, and he retreated into the Ardennes forest and would stay out there in the woods for days and weeks at a time. The Ardennes is both a forest and a mountain range. It's like a region collectively, whose name maybe comes from Julius Caesar, who could have named it Arduena Silva, or deep forest, back when the land was a part of Roman Gaul. I also saw an alternate etymology meaning forest of fair heights. So basically, it's a big ass forest. It's scary. It's gorgeous. I want to go there. Its folklore is particularly cool. I didn't get into it too much because it didn't feel like my territory, but I was skimming articles about fairies, gnomes, goblins, elves, a Celtic goddess, the works. So it has a very rich folkloric tradition. So this next part of the story, why is my nose so fucking itchy? I'm going to scream. My God. Sorry. This next part of the story, I have to be upfront about. It was not included in St. Hubert's hagiography until the 15th century. It's not in the original. And it has a lot in common with a story in the hagiography of St. Eustace. And the timing suggests that it was probably appropriated from that hagiography. Make of that what you will, but it has become like the essential part of Hubert's story, which I think is interesting. Like, even if he was a real person, this probably didn't happen to him, but now it's like the most iconic part. Anyway, the legend goes that on one Good Friday morning, while all the good Christians were attending mass, Hubert was out hunting with his Busch Light. In particular, he had been stalking this magnificent stag. He had like tracked it for days and finally had it within range to kill it when it suddenly turned toward him and he realized that the stag had a glowing crucifix floating between its antlers. He heard a voice saying, "Hubert, unless thou turnest to the Lord and leadest a holy life, thou shalt quickly go down into hell." At that point, I would shit my pants.
It's like, what have I touched recently? What have I eaten?
That mushroom. Obviously, this was quite a shock, but Hubert immediately dismounted from his horse and lay flat on the ground, asking, "Lord, what wouldst thou have me do?" And the voice told him, "Go and seek Lambert, and he will instruct you." Before we get too far from the stag story, I realized that I have a prop for my story. Oh. Can you see this?
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a, for the listeners, I have a little shooter of Jägermeister in my hand. Don't ask me why. It's nobody's business but my own. And the logo, if you don't know, if you're not familiar, for Jaeger is a stag with a crucifix between its antlers. I'll post it on Instagram too for those non-alcoholics in the audience. Where was I? Okay. Hubert's like, "Oh my God, I know a Lambert. He is the bishop of Maastricht." So that's where he immediately set out for. Lambert welcomed him and became his spiritual director. Under Lambert's guidance, Hubert renounced all of his fancy positions, and titles. He gave up his birthright to the region of Aquitaine to his younger brother, Odo. And he made Odo the guardian of his infant son, Floribert. So he really said, "Fuck the world, I'm out." Like, not even taking care of his kid anymore. Just like, peace. After he had done all this, Lambert instructed Hubert to distribute all his wealth among the poor, and then to retreat into the forest to care for the people and animals that lived in the Ardennes region. He was ordained a priest and became one of Lambert's chief associates, helping him run the diocese. In the year 708, Lambert was summoned to Rome, but he requested that Hubert make the trip in his place. I don't know why. Maybe he was really busy. Maybe he was old. Maybe he just wasn't feeling it. He's like, no, I actually am not going to walk 1,000 miles. Sorry. Who knows? Let's send the feral man from the forest to visit the Pope in my place and just see how fucking well that goes. So Hubert went, and in his absence, Lambert was fucking assassinated.
Oops. Well, you should have gone on that trip.
Probably should have gone.
Hindsight.
You know, you can't win them all. You can't make every right decision.
I think he made 2 wrong decisions.
So far, 2. And the second one killed him. So there's a lesson there for all of us. Don't make any decisions.
Ever.
Let someone else decide the entire course of your life for you. And everything will work out great.
And maybe you'll get to meet the Pope.
Maybe. Who's to say? Later sources told me that Lambert was assassinated by followers of Pepin. I don't know why. I don't know what that beef was. I know that Pepin was very militaristic and that he conquered a bunch of land for the Frankish Empire, but I don't know for sure if or why he had Lambert assassinated. And it's not in the original hagiography. The original one just says that Lambert died, like, not that he was assassinated at all. So, like, literally, what is happening? And did any of this even take place? Who knows? But I like the story that there was this, like, feud between them. And I don't think it's crazy because church leaders and kings are always fighting. They never get along. So it's definitely possible. Either way, Hubert was appointed Lambert's successor as Bishop of Maastricht. Legend says he was a total baller shot caller as bishop. He freaking killed it. He distributed all the revenue from tithing to the poor. He became known for his fasting and his prayer, as well as his eloquence in speaking. In the year 720, Hubert had a vision, which told him that he needed to translate Lambert's relics from Maastricht to Liege, which he did. He had a basilica built to house the relics, which became St. Lambert's Cathedral. I will post pictures of the... Well, they're not pictures. They're illustrations, because the cathedral has since been destroyed. It was destroyed during the Protestant Reformation. So no photographs, but the illustrations are cool. Liège at the time was just a little village in the middle of nowhere. So this laid the foundations for its future as like a huge like epicenter of Catholicism during the later Middle Ages and onward. As we've seen, many of my stories take place in Liège. It was the beginning of the Beguine movement. Just a lot of like that border between France and Belgium was like super important. And this was what put Liège on the map. Hubert also became the first bishop of Liège. It's at this point that later hagiographies, beginning, I believe, in the 12th or 13th centuries, include another iconic story of St. Hubert, which is a vision that he had during his consecration as Bishop of Liège. It's said that he was visited by St. Peter, as in the apostle and first pope. St. Peter gave Hubert a golden key and told him that God was granting him a special power against evil spirits. Also, apparently, some angels came down and gave him a special stole, which is the thing that goes like, you know, the thing that goes like that. For the listeners, it's the thing that goes like that. Where was I? The thing that goes like that. Soon after his consecration, Hubert is said to have miraculously cured a man who had been bitten by a rabid dog. Because of this, Hubert became known as a protector against rabies, which apparently was a big concern of the time. Scary times. And after he died, people made pilgrimages to his shrine in order to pray for protection from rabies or to be cured of it. Those who could not make the pilgrimage would buy artifacts called St. Hubert's keys, which were pieces of iron in the shape of a nail, a cross, or a little cone. These artifacts were often hung on the wall for protection against rabies. But more directly, if someone had been bitten by a rabid dog, the keys would be, this is super gross, the keys would be heated until they were like red hot, and they would let me stop stuttering, and they would be placed directly on the body where the bite had occurred. Often priests would be the one to do this.
So you get bit by a rabid dog and you get burned. You get branded.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Back to back. Just the worst day of your entire life.
Absolutely.
So often priests would be the ones to do this. And at the same time, they would perform an operation known as cutting, where they would make an incision on the afflicted person's forehead and insert a thread said to have been taken from St. Hubert's miraculous stole.
Absolutely the worst day of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Do not get by a dog.
Yeah. The forehead would then be bound with a bandage for 9 days. This was big. This treatment was big in the Liège area, but also all throughout Europe and for a long time. Like, there are cases of this treatment up until the late 19th century, like 1870s. People are still doing this.
With this weird shit, like, bear with me. We're going to cut open your forehead.
Mm-hmm.
Some weird magic shit. Don't worry. And then we're 9 days. We're going to wrap it up for 9 days. Why 9 days?
Probably the length of a novena, but... Again, why? Like, 3 would be good, too, probably.
You could pick any number and it has some sort of significance.
Well, okay, it's funny that you mentioned that. You remember the book, The Name of the Rose? I was rereading that recently, and it's exactly that. The guy will be like, oh, this building is important because it has 12 sides, like the 12 apostles, and it has 9 windows, like blah, 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 which is obviously the most perfect number. And then it has 18, whatever, which is obviously a super important number because of blah, blah, blah. It's like literally every number. It's like 1 is the most important number because there's 1 God. 2 is the most important number because of marriage. 3 is the most important because of the Trinity. Shut up. Be fucking for real. Anywho, so they're doing this like through the 1870s, and they probably did it for so long because it could actually work. Not the forehead thing. Forget the forehead thing. There's nothing going on with that. It's not real. But the key, the iron, when used quickly enough after the bite, could actually cauterize and sterilize the wound and kill the rabies virus. So it wasn't crazy. There was something to it. They didn't know it, but they were right. They didn't know what they were doing.
Science.
They just picked like 3 random things out of a hat, and it happened that like 1 of them
worked.
Hubert spent the rest of his relatively long life evangelizing, which, as we all know, is the code word that means ruining pagan people's lives. He also continued to spend as much time as he could in the forest. People regarded him as an authority on matters of the forest. And whenever decisions were made about the forest, he was consulted. I'm like, what are the decisions? No one told me.
To be a forest authority.
Right. That was him. His job. His official title. He died on May 30th, 727, in a place that the hagiographies called Fura. This was most likely near the modern-day town of Voren, about 30 miles from Liège. And I think he was 71 years old, so not bad. He was originally buried in St. Peter's Church in Liège, but in 825, his remains were reinterred at the Benedictine Abbey of St. Hubert in the Ardennes. His feast day is November 3rd. It's coming up. Which was probably the date of his relic translation. Like I said, he is venerated as the patron saint of hunters. There's also this like popular storyline. I'm not sure where it comes from, but the storyline is that he was kind of the originator of ethical hunting behavior, which eye roll, has white colonizer vibes all over it. Like, Native yes. people have known how to hunt ethically, like, forever. Like,
the only hunting I saw this man do was clearly high on shrooms talking to a deer.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And guess what? That's so ethical of him.
Yes.
He didn't kill it. He didn't hunt it. So
we should all talk to deer and change our entire life paths depending on what they say.
I stand by that. If a deer talked to me, I would listen.
I would probably change my behavior. We would have to consult whether it was like the devil or God talking to me, but I would rethink what I was doing.
Yeah, I mean, you have to. If you don't, if you're just like, another deer spoke to me, like, what are you talking about? But the reason why this might be the case is that in some versions of the story, the stag in the forest actually, like, lectures Hubert about, like, how he's supposed to, like, he hasn't been hunting the right way. And he needs to be more respectful of animals because they're God's creatures too. And they have like value in their own right, not just as like food or trophies, which is kind of like a very preachy, like almost like vegan moment, which I think is really funny. Like he gets high on shrooms and becomes a vegan. he doesn't, but anyway. So things like the hunter should only shoot when he can guarantee a clean and quick kill. He should only shoot old stags that are like past their prime. And he should never shoot mothers with young because then the young won't be able to find their way home. So this isn't in every version of his story, but it's become associated with him. And there are many hunting societies and animal management societies that are dedicated to St. Hubert. There's also a festival in his honor in Slovakia called St. Hubertus Days, which takes place each September and includes a market, music, a hunting dog show, falconry demonstrations, and antique rifle demonstrations. Honestly, sounds like a fucking blast. They do it on these manor grounds that are like really beautiful and picturesque. And this is now a tourism commercial. And that's where I'll end it. That is the story of St. Hubert of Liège. You're welcome.
I am going to think about him every time I see a bottle of Jägermeister.
As you should.
Which is almost daily for me. Not an alcoholic. I just shop for people for a living.
This is when we find out that Liz is like a raging alcoholic who drinks like... Jaeger
full time.
Jaeger and her coffee, like some vile shit.
That's why I was sick on Thursday. Not an ear infection. I was just drunk off my ass.
Been there.
So I'm cheating today. My story is not about a witch or a witch trial, but it is vaguely supernatural, so I think it counts, kind of.
Cool.
It's got forests, it's got hunts, it's got rabid behavior. I checked those boxes.
Hey, we're there.
So without further ado, I'm dropping us into southern France in the province of Gévaudan, which will soon be plagued by a terrifying beast.
Ooh.
The year is 1764, so about 1,000 years after your story.
That's fine.
And a couple hours away, but close.
Close enough.
Close. I tried. The French have just recently declared their defeat in the Seven Years' War. So not only do we have the like hardships you would expect to see in the country like post-war, but you got a lot of men with like really wounded pride right now. And they're just desperate to prove themselves and to rally around something.
I don't like that.
No, it's going to be a good thing. But yeah, they're just looking for something to do to feel useful. So Gévaudan is rocky countryside. I haven't looked up the area, but I based on what I've read through the accounts, it seems like it's pretty treacherous. Like, if you don't know what you're doing, then you're going to get hurt real easy.
And I never know what I'm doing, so I probably shouldn't go.
Don't hike there.
Got it.
Houses are spread far apart and not unusually for the time or place. The area depends on agriculture as like a way of life and survival. So you have a lot of people, children especially, off in the countryside tending herds for their families, alone and defenseless.
I'm scared.
One source said it was illegal for anyone outside the aristocracy to own guns at this time period. I cannot attest to that. Anytime I tried to look it up, all I got was just a bunch of information about like the storming of the Bastille or whatever. Like, this is when the French got guns. I'm like, did they have them before though? I understand they acquired them in this scenario. Did they possess them before this?
Interesting.
I don't know. Regardless, these kids are sitting ducks for any sort of trouble that may come their way. And come their way it does.
Mm-mm.
So in May-ish of 1764, a young girl is attacked by a wild animal, quote, like a wolf, yet not like a wolf.
What?
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
Okay.
She escapes with her life when the bulls in her herd, like, drive the creature away. She gets, like, super lucky that the animals go on the offensive for her. And the incident is kind of just written off and put out of mind. It's not, like, a huge deal is made out of it. Mm-hmm. Until 2 months later. On June 30th, 1764, 14-year-old Jim Boulet is out tending her family's herd. I think it's sheep. She is later found with her throat torn out. Yes. She's buried without sacraments on the 1st of July, and her death certificate specifies that she was killed by, quote, la bête féroce, which is just the ferocious beast.
What the fuck?
And it kind of implies that this creature had been spotted or had attacked, though maybe not killed, others in like those intervening 2 months. Like, they're the ferocious beast. It's like, this thing is known.
Right. Wait, why was she buried without sacraments?
I yanking it out of my memory, it said something about her dying like immediately. Like, they just find her body, and there was some Catholic thing that they couldn't do because all they found was her corpse.
Well, I mean, yeah, they couldn't give her, like, last rites. But, yeah. Like, I was like, I thought it meant, like, she's not even going to be given, like, a Christian burial. I was like, why? That's so mean.
I think she still gets a Christian burial, but okay. They noted that, like, there was no finding her, like, in dire straits, and she passed away in Got somebody's, it. Like, we literally just found, like, her body out in the wilderness.
Got it.
Yes. On August 8th, about a month later, this beast claims another victim, another 14-year-old girl. And deaths soon begin to stack up, like, very fast in this 50 square miles of and around the Nequois Forest. I didn't look that one up, so total guess. Because of the wild area, the frenzy, the number of kills, and the timing between them, some of them happening at like close to the same time. Rumors abound about what this beast of Gévaudan is, and if it's possible that there's more than one of them.
Hmm.
The accounts that are circulating by mouth paint pictures of this unrecognizable monster. It's bigger than a wolf. It has a tail like a snake. It can stand on its hind legs, can leap great distances, and is impervious to bullets in the few instances that it has been shot at. They're like, we shot it and it ran away.
Oh my god. It's like a fucking, what's that lion looking thing? A manticore?
Yeah. So
okay.
I will put up some illustrations of the beast.
Yes.
The bishop over the area orders prayers and penance to like solve problems.
Thoughts and prayers.
It does nothing to stop or slow the relentless slaughter of children, women, and the occasional man. The common people are kind of reluctant to mount an official hunt from what I read, because what's the payoff? They aren't armed well. They don't know what they're hunting. And they obviously have jobs and lives that, like, they need to be getting to. One of the, like, videos I watched about it clearly was filmed during the pandemic, because they kept making, like, references to the pandemic. Like, current times, they're like, yeah, well, people were dying during the COVID and everything, but we also had to pay our bills and pay rent. So, like, it was not always the biggest of concerns.
That's so true.
Yeah. It's like, cannot put my, like, desire for food on hold.
Yeah.
So that's kind of that. It's like, how am I supposed to fit it into my schedule? And there were plenty of, like I said, men with wounded pride and everything who wanted to help. But with the current resources, it's like, who's going to pay me to go do this right now?
Right. No. It's like, so I have crops, I have to do laundry, and I have to hunt the ferocious beast.
Go fuck yourself.
I can't fit all these things in my day. Like, there's not enough hours in the day to hunt the ferocious beast.
Yeah. And more parallels that they were drawing, but like that and the pandemic was like, the authorities are like, we would really appreciate it if you guys would stay at home and stop getting eaten by the ferocious beast. And they're like, you gonna pay me to stay home? And the government's like, we are not. And they're like, then I will be at work.
Then I will be out in the fields and I will take my chances with the ferocious beast.
Yeah. So.
Whoa. This is so COVID.
Yes. Very COVID. In January of 1765. So it has been less than a year, but we're in the next year. So we started in like May of 64. We're in January of 65 now. 10-year-old Jacques Portefeuille and 7 other kids are attacked outside. But as a group, with Jacques leading the charge, they fend off the monster with sticks.
I want this as a movie.
News of this miraculous event makes its way to King Louis XV, who pays Jacques. I did not look up how to pronounce this. So 300 livres. I don't know, LIVRES, whatever that money is.
Sure. So,
didn't Google it. And offers 350 more to be split between the other 7 kids. So, like, Jacques is super special, and the other kids get, like, the same amount, but they don't just split it.
And they're like, what the fuck? I also fought off the ferocious beast with a stick.
Exactly. Jacques is also awarded an education at, like, the king's personal expense.
Whoa.
He's like super special. It was a big deal. Mm-hmm. There are illustrations of Jacques and the kids fighting the monster, and I will post one.
Nice.
After this, France is like, okay, we have got to like officially start doing something about this beast of Gévaudan. We're going to have hunts. We're going to offer like a year's salary reward to whoever can kill it. Meanwhile, the slaughter is just persisting. Except now, it's the king knows about it, and it's in the papers.
Right.
Without the war to report on, I thought this was kind of an interesting little note in the story. Newspapers, which typically didn't concern themselves with small village matters like animal attacks, pretty much different in the way that, like, if it wasn't political, they really didn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to kind of start, like, this new style of reporting where we, like, look at everyday matters that are going on around us that aren't political. So no war, space to fill, this new type of reporting. And then they get these animal attacks. And they're like, you know what? Not only can we shit talk the French royals, like, ineffectual efforts to hunt down a measly animal, which is mm-hmm. fun. We can also make bank sensationalizing the hell out of this animal.
I love that. They're like, we got to print this.
Right now,
hot off the presses. It's like, I'm picturing like the 1920s, like cigars and everything. It's not right.
So the Cuyo d'Avignon, I have no idea. Cuyo d'Avignon is the first paper to latch onto the story. And interestingly, the Beast of Givaudan more or less becomes like the first international headlines kind of in history as a result. Papers in France pick up the tale, but papers across Europe follow. So you see it in Belgium, you see it in England, you see it in Russia. Like, everybody is talking about these animal attacks just in this little province in the south of France.
That's so cool.
Yeah, total clickbait.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine how blown out of proportion the monster gets. The more popular it gets and the further the story spreads. So what was a wolf, but bigger than a wolf, impervious to bullets, with a snake tail and a great leap and the ability to stand on its hind legs, soon becomes that, but also a reddish-gray beast with a black stripe down its back, its eyes gleaming like the sun or maybe like fire. It has a long snout and claws. No, it has hooves. And its breath smells like rot, and it can talk.
Whoa, is it me, or is this beast kind of hot? It's like the spam, like, ads, like,
yes,
hot, ferocious beast in your area. Oh, God.
It gets to the point where people are like, it's definitely supernatural. It could even possibly be a werewolf, like, it could be a werewolf ravaging the French countryside.
Yeah.
There's plenty of speculation both then and now about what the Beast of Givaudan was. Like, we still don't even really know. Prevailing theories are that it wasn't one beast, but rather random wolves across the area. Maybe rabid wolves, maybe not. Or it could have been a prehistoric creature holdover, though that's not a super popular opinion, nor is the opinion that it was someone's trained war dog being set on people.
Yikes.
Still in the realm of imagination, but outside of the realm of supernatural, it's possible the creature was something more along the lines of a hyena or a subadult lion that had potentially got loose from an aristocrat's menagerie.
That's true. I mean, people were doing some wild shit back then.
Absolutely crazy shit. I kind of waffle between, like, random wolves and the lion.
Yeah. I could see the lion because of the lion's tail.
Mm-hmm.
Which, the way, like...
Oh, the tail. The way they talk about how high it can jump, how big it is.
Right.
And current scientists are like, well, if you look at, like, a subadult lion before it really has its mane, like, it does appear to have, like, a stripe down its back. For kind of, like, mohawks.
Right. Interesting. So
they're, like, potentially lion is, like, our best-ish guess.
Okay. Because you've
seen they illustrate animals that they don't know what they are.
Yeah.
So at it.
Some of my favorite illustrations of all time.
Oh, I love it so much.
Yeah.
Anyway, the state issues images of the beast, like, out to the public to familiarize people in the area with it to reduce terror, which is funny to me, like, saturating the media with a ferocious beast in an attempt to desensitize the populace. It's like a major gamble. It's like, either this is going to freak everybody the fuck out, or this is going to go great.
Yeah, it's like exposure therapy.
Pretty much is what, like, they were to do.
Maybe in the hands of a trained professional, but are just some random, like, newspapers. Like, I don't know about this.
Got a bunch, give it to everybody.
Right.
Tell them it's coming now, it will kill them.
And then everything will be fine.
What the fuck? They also do this apparently so that people could train their hunting dogs with, like, cutouts of the beast. Like, they could make life-size cutouts and be like, that's the thing you kill. Go after that. Fido. Attack.
The cutout thing is so funny. I'm imagining someone, like, people making them and like, okay, can I borrow your ferocious beast cutout? I gotta train my dog. Like, and I don't want to make a whole new one, and yours is so good. Like,
that, or can I trace it?
Right, just let me trace it.
Can I have it for like an hour?
Right.
By February of this year, you have France dispatching officials to hunt the beast in Gévaudan, but the officials get frustrated because the locals are like trying to live their lives mostly and go to work and aren't really coordinating with them. So they get mad at the villagers' incompetence at beast hunting, or how when they chase like the beast toward them, they like won't do anything about it because they have other concerns or aren't trained for this. So they'll be like, yeah, I shot it and I chased it straight into the village, and then they let it go. It's like, they're like, if they had just mounted an offensive and been on the other side, and like, we could have cornered the bastard. It's like, why though? You chased it into town.
Right. These are just random farmers.
Yeah. Come on, man. They're not getting paid for this. They might get paid afterward, but they're not currently getting paid to do this.
Right.
Two professional wolf hunters, Denival and his son, are sent to the area, which causes a fuss because their strategies to hunt down the beast do not mesh with the strategies currently being employed by officials in the area. The officials want like these mass hunting parties. Like, we're all going to go out on horses with a 500 fucking men and we're going to hunt down the wolf. Father and son are like, no, we want to sneak through the woods just real stealthily. And we're going to track it down and we're going to shoot it. And they're like, we cannot have both. It's got to be one or the other.
Right.
So the officials say, peace out, Girl Scout, we're gone. And leave the duo to it. Mm-hmm. Father and son fail spectacularly for like 4 months. And they are yoinked off the mission at the end of May when what I think was a single day, the beast attacks 20-year-old Marguerite Martin on the roadside, continues along its path to attack an 11-year-old boy, then finally corners a young boy and girl in the woods. The young boy attempts to save his 13-year-old female companion, but fails, and after returning with help, finds her headless, eating corpse.
Oh my god.
And I think there are like 16 decapitations attached to the beast. Like, it went for like the head and throat.
Oh my god. This is gruesome.
It's gruesome. The father and son hunting duo set up an ambush at the body. I don't know if they moved the body, if it was the side of the body, or they're like, nah, just leave the 13-year-old on the ground and let's wait for the beast to come back.
Just let her fucking rot.
Guys. But instead of returning, the beast instead travels along its way and attacks two more people for a total of like 6 people, 7 people in one day. I lost count.
Jesus.
Too many. But like that, after 4 months of failure, everyone was like, man, you guys suck at your fucking jobs.
You're done.
So suffering, quote, shame tantamount to that of a fox who has been caught by a chicken.
Whoa. Quote,
which I think is funny if you think about it. The duo are replaced in June by the king's 71-year-old gun bearer, Francois, and the hunting party he selects.
Another 7-year-old, 1-year-old man. Yeah, I can't just skim past the 71-year-old gun. What's his title?
Bearer Francois.
Gun bearer Francois. God bless.
He seems like a relatively nice dude from what I've read of him. Like, competent, not, like, nice, kind, but not gentle. I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to say.
All right, I'll date him.
Year-old cumber.
He was your friend that you were trying to set me up with. Like, all right, I'll give him a chance.
Francois' correspondences over the following months highlight the exceptionally tricky terrain of the area. He's like, this is the most difficult place I've ever had to hunt in. Like, just FYI, this place sucks ass to hunt in. And he urges for more dogs and hands to help because he's like, one, I just need more people to begin with, but two, like, our dogs are tired as fuck, like, trying to hunt in this landscape. I need more dogs. On the 11th of August, Francois is notified of the beast's location and rushes over to find 20-year-old Marie Jembele and her younger sister near a river. One of the stories says that they were trying to cross the river at the time. I don't know, by boat, by bridge, by something. There's a river involved. Marie, armed with only a bayonet tied to the end of a staff, stabbed the beast and knocked it into the river where it thrashed around before fleeing.
Hell yeah.
Though Francois is certain the beast is still alive, some in his party think that it is dead. He praises Marie, likens her to Joan of Arc, and then writes a letter to the king requesting a reward for her. It's like, she's pretty dope. She's a good kid.
She deserves cute.
Yeah, that's why I think that he's, like, a pretty, like, decent dude.
Yeah.
You see, Marie becomes known as the Maid of Gévaudan, and a statue of her encounter with the beast still stands, I believe. There's definitely a photo of it, and I will post that. In the following months, sure enough, beast attacks resume, which people are very sad about because they thought that, like, the little girl managed to kill it. Hooray.
And I mean,
dying again, and they're like, aw.
Oh. Well.
Weigh the wine. Stop the parade.
They're like, oh, well, we already made the statue, so.
And at this point, Francois had been, like, really disheartened by everything and was, like, going to turn in his resignation because he's like, I'm not good at this. I'm not accomplishing anything. I'm done. But then, kind of in the nick of time, all of the reinforcements that he had requested, like, weeks and weeks ago show up. Mm. He's like, well, let me just discreetly burn my resignation letter. And back to business. So he organizes a hunt and corners the monster in the Palmier Woods. And after a gruesome fight, the beast is killed.
Wow.
This beast is a wolf 6 feet long, 3 feet tall, and 140 pounds in weight. Though a number of villagers specifically identified this wolf as the beast of Gévaudan, even Maligine is like, yeah, that's the thing that I stabbed in the river. A necropsy reveals no human remains in the stomach or intestines of this wolf.
Mm.
It is stuffed and it is sent to the king as a beautiful present. And the king is underwhelmed, to say the least, because he's like, this is a wolf. Y'all can tell me about this fucking beast of Gévaudan. It's a wolf.
The fucking wolf. Yeah.
But, like, he's invested so much time and so much money into this, and he wants everybody to shut the fuck up about it. And also, he doesn't want to tell his official, like, congratulations, buddy, you killed a wolf. Where's the beast of Gévaudan? He's like, good job, Francois. You defeated the beast. Here's your reward. Problem solved, everybody.
Francois is like, thank you, Barbie.
So, eager to close the matter, he accepts the wolf as the beast, while Francois kind of dedicates himself to hunting down any cubs the wolf may have had, along with its mate, to moderate success. He does kill a she-wolf and a cub, but I think the second cub he shoots runs away. So they're like, eh. We think we managed to, like, solve the problem for the next crisis, but not really.
Yeah.
It is quiet for a time. For a couple of months, it's quiet. But in December of that year, 1765, sporadic attacks pick up again.
Oh, no.
At this point, the king and newspapers, like, no longer give a shit. They're like, the beast is dead. This is now officially your problem. We want to hear nothing of the sort. We definitely solved the problem. Some of the stranger things, by the way, that people and officials did to hunt the beast were recommending that they lay traps in the form of poisoned dog corpses, which is really fucking weird. They're like, well, we have all these dead dogs, we might as well just poison them and lay them in areas for the beasts to wander around and see if that solves the issue.
We have all these dead dogs, might as well put them to good use.
Pretty much. You imagine walking out with like your kids and be like, don't touch that dead dog, they poisoned it for the beast of Chevron.
That's a working dead dog. Like a service dog.
But she's the best.
That's disgusting.
It is. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
The other thing that they did was they dressed in drag. The thought being that the beast was mostly going after women and kids. Probably they were the ones dying because they were young and defenseless.
Right.
So they're like, what if we just dress up like defenseless peasant women and plant ourselves in the countryside as bait?
Oh my god. This is a movie.
Yes. And I wish with all of my heart that I could reincarnate as like an 18th century cross-dressing Frenchman hunting a mythical beast in the woods.
What could like, be better?
The money I would pay.
Yes.
Many, many moons later, like 18 months later, a man named Jean Chastel, who was previously thrown in jail, I guess, for being like a horrendously shitty guide to Francois and leading his men into a bog during a hunt, which
I oh my god,
we thought they're like jail immediately.
Wait, that's fucking funny.
He's like, I'm sorry, I took a wrong turn. I wasn't.
And you're like, don't want to hear it. Go to your cell. I love that.
Which is why, like, Francois, like, no nonsense. Nice, but no nonsense.
He was like, get this guy out of here.
I got my boots dirty.
Mm-hmm. How dare you?
Anyway. Jean joins a newly organized hunt since attacks have kind of escalated at this period of time and kills a beast on the 19th of June, 1767. So it has been about 3 years at this point, almost 2 years. There are plenty of little fun made-up stories of him doing like badassery things during the killing of the beast. One person says that he melted down Virgin Mary metal into bullets, and that's what he used to kill it, like heavy artillery kill it.
I love that.
Yes. Other people have him like reciting prayers during the hunt. So
not as cool, but
no, anything that they can do to like make it a little bit more important than some man in camo overall standing in the woods in a wolf.
Drinking Bush Light.
Yes. He did not kill it ethically, I don't think.
Probably not.
Anything was killed ethically over the course of this story.
Doesn't sound like it.
I'm so sorry.
They're like injecting the dead dogs with poison. Like, yes. Yeah, I don't know about like, that. I don't know if PETA would be too fond of this whole situation.
No. Violates so much. Anyway, boy is sitting right there, by the way.
Oh, hi, Hannibal. What are you doing?
Try to hurry up before he makes this everybody's problem. What's in my lap?
Oh.
Anyway, the beast body is shipped off for necropsy, and it arrives in condition.
What?
They don't have refrigerated trucks or anything fancy, so they killed it out in the woods, and by the time it makes its way to the surgeon or whoever is going to like investigate it, it's been shot and it's decomposed a little bit, it's gone through shipping and handling, like
I don't like that.
Sorry.
It's okay.
There is a report. I think I'll probably post at least one of the photos from it. I think it's like 3-ish pages long of like the actual like kind of royal necropsy that was done on this animal. But they still can't definitively say that it was a wolf, which speaks to the level of its condition,
I think. Yeah, a little too much shipping and handling.
It gets worse, I'm sorry.
Oh, God.
All involved wanted to give the, like, body to the king, like they did with the last one. but they stuffed it, like, really poorly, like, with straw. And it was the summer, and they make so many mentions to how hot it was. So there's no end to the descriptions of the horrendous stench and condition of this taxidermied animal.
That is disgusting.
It's the point that they're like, not only do we not want to, like, confront the whole, like, Francois already killed it, he didn't do a good job, like, hold situation, but we basically do not want to put this in the same room as the king. It would be the greatest insult.
Yeah, he opens the door, and it's like, I'm picturing, like, the level of decomposition that's, like, the birthday cake in Sleeping Beauty.
Yes, pretty much.
Like, it's held up by a broom handle.
They're like,
it's just leaking.
But it would be a national incident if we allowed it in the same room as the king. We can't.
Yeah, thank God someone had that good sense.
Yeah, they, like, shamefully bury it in somebody's
garden. Oh my God.
Anyway. Deep breath. I can get through this last paragraph. Reportedly, there were no more attacks in Chavanon following this. So Chastel, however you want to say it, and his huntsmen were paid, though not near as much as previous hunters or even notable victims were paid. All in all, the kill count of this beast is unknown, but it's speculated to be between 1 and 200 people.
Jeez.
Area. And that is the entire stretch of, like, 1764 to 1767, like, all totaled up. Low ends put it at 100, high ends, I've seen it as high as 300, but I think that that's bullshit. So I would say between 1 and 200. We might never know exactly what it was that plagued the area, but that is the story of the Beast of Chavanon.
Oh my God, that story had everything.
It had Frenchmen in drag. It had poison dogs. It had shamefully burying taxidermy in your backyard.
Bad taxidermy. Who doesn't love a horrible taxidermy? Oh, that was good. Good job.
Thank you.
I'm thinking of the person whose yard they buried it in.
They find, like, things later. What the fuck is this?
Oh, that's so gross. This is such a funny combination of stories. It's like, oh, the ethical hunting standards. And then it's like the worst taxidermy you can possibly imagine.
I like that. That was fun.
It was.
Hallucinated deer, poorly stuffed wolves.
We've seen it all. What else is there? Yeah, I do think we had quite a bit in common, but also not at all.
Yes, and not even a little bit.
Yes, and in a much more real sense, no. Those are my favorite times on the podcast, though, when it's like, I see what we were going for, but...
Like I said, I checked, like, two of the boxes that you gave me, and then I ran away with the rest of them.
Yeah. No, it was worth it for that story.
I hope it sticks with our listeners.
I'm sure it will. The stench alone will never leave me. Do we have anything else to mention?
I don't think so. Hannibal is sitting like a poor Victorian orphan child in the window.
Oh.
He's doing, he's got like his little feet bunched up and he's watching the window that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's entirely too human and I don't like it.
Yeah, sometimes the cats will be like really, really human where I'm like, you are a person in there. And yeah, you've seen me naked.
I would watch out the window. Yeah, I can't get undressed in front of Hannibal.
Yeah, it's weird. In that case, on that note, thank you all so much for listening. We love you. We adore you.
You're the love of our life.
Basically. And we'll see you next time. Thanks be to God.
Blessed be. Thank you.